So this week we're into week five of this process I've been going through of deconstructing the Satipatthana Sutta and the Buddhist instructions on mindfulness. And today's topic is the second foundation, which is Vedana. And I'm going to read from the sutta and then talk about it. And there are two sections to this particular verse. This is verse 32 of the Satipatthana Sutta for anybody who cares about that sort of thing. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating feelings as feelings? Here, when a feeling, a pleasant feeling, a bhikkhu understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, he understands, I feel a painful a feeling. When feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I am feeling a neither a painful nor unpleasant feeling, sometimes called a neutral feeling. Sometimes this translation uses the word painful. Some translations use the words unpleasant, which I find more comfortable than painful. And so I'll probably refer to it as unpleasant. So that's the first section. And what is, so first of all, before we go any further, I have to, there's the word feeling itself. And here, feeling has a very special, precise meaning that isn't the same as when we are in our normal daily conversation talking about, I've got a feeling for X or Y, or I feel good about something, you know. It's feeling here. I've actually seen it translated as feeling tone. It's almost like the flavor of what I'm feeling, the mood of what I'm feeling. But even that is very, very precise. There are basically, it can only be one of three things. It can be pleasant, it can be unpleasant, it can be neutral. That's it. So it has nothing to do with feelings like joy and anger and all those sorts of things. They might come after, but feeling tone, Vedana, is a the first of the mental factors. Like the first whole section we've been talking about for the last 4 weeks has been about mindfulness of body. And now the Buddha's moved into how the mind works. And he separates out this particular mental arising as for special attention. And this is, he's also uses and talks about Vedana in two other significant places. And I'll mention that, and actually I'll go into one great detail about one of them. But this is like a central part of what the Buddha is trying to do here. And we also need to understand that basically there's the something arises at one of the sense doors. And for every arising at any of the sense doors that we actually notice, that's an important note, that we actually notice, Vedana then arises. So, because we have like 20 arisings at the sense doors every second, and we don't notice many of them. They just whiz on by. So it's said that for Vedana to arise, there has to be some sort of stimulation, you know, a sound wave or a taste or a thought or whatever arising, because the mind is just another sense door. Has to be some stimulation arising. There has to be a functioning organ that receives it. And there has to be what's called the consciousness that's available at that particular sense organ. Because, and all three of those factors have to be present before we actually have a moment of what's called contact. And contact creates, causes Vedana to arise. One of those three things, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Always, that's what comes next. And it's also important to understand that the contact and the mental formation of Vedana, this pleasant, unpleasant, neutral sensation, mental sensation, are separate. The thing about Vedana is it happens so quickly that we often start sort of sticking it together with the contact itself and thinking that's one thing. They're actually two distinctly separate things. There's contact, and then there's Vedana arising. And so, and the reason that's what I just said is important is we start to, if we're not careful, thinking, well, this thing, whatever it is always pleasant. And one of my teachers had this great example he used to use. So I want you to think about your favorite secret snack, right? Something that you just really like. And it could be like Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream, it could be Doritos, it could be carrot sticks. It doesn't make any difference. There's something you really, really like. Okay, so get that in your mind really clear. Oh boy, I'm gonna have that. And then imagine someone, I give you a bowl. And it's like, wow, carrot sticks. Oh, great. Or whatever it is. So you're gonna get pleasant. A pleasant Vedana will arise. The moment of contact, seeing that thing or smelling it, Vedana will arise. That'll be pleasant. And you eat that bowl of stuff, whatever it is. And then, as soon as you finish, I then hand you another bowl. Say, now eat that one. And it's not the same, that second bowl. It's like, oh boy, it's my favorite thing. But it's like, by the time you're sort of halfway through that second bowl, it's like, oh well, I suppose I should eat this because he gave it to me and he's my teacher. So I said, follow along what they say. But it's like, now it's just neutral. It's like, I like this stuff, but it's like, eh. And then you finish that second bowl, and I hand you a third bowl, and you look at the bowl, and you go, oh God, there's no way. Now it's unpleasant. Same object. Went from pleasant to neutral to unpleasant. So the pleasant, the Vedana is based on both the object and the causes and conditions that created that object to be there at that moment. There has to be those two things together. And noting Vedana can be quite interesting if you can actually start to see Vedana, that separate mental formation, separate from what actually arose. Because it's so simple. It's sometimes quite, if you can start tuning into it, it's interesting because one of the things noting Vedana allows you to see is that, 10 minutes ago you had that sound of the wind in the leaves and you were like, oh, so nice. And then you're still sitting there and there's still that sound of the leaves and now it's kind of annoying. Same sound, nothing's changed, except 10 minutes have passed and causes and conditions are different and now it's annoying. So you start to see the impermanence of everything. It's a way to start tuning into impermanence. So that's the idea behind Vedana and why it's important. Because and now I want to actually talk about another teaching, which is called the 12 Steps of Codependent Arising. This is a very famous teaching of the Buddha. That's sort of original to the Buddhist teaching. You don't find it in any other Eastern philosophical discussions. It's unique to the Buddha. And it's something he noticed, and it led him to a lot of interesting understandings. And so, first of all, what does codependent arising mean? It's a very philosophical term. Basically, it means if A arises, if A happens, then B must happen. So if something happens, then if A happens, then B must happen. But it also means here's the codependent part. If B happens, it must be because A happened. So it works in both directions and they're linked together and they're sequential. Okay, so that's the idea behind codependent arising. And so basically, the first few steps are very sort of philosophical. And so I like to start this discussion such that the first step I want to talk about is causes and conditions are such that something arises at one of the six sense doors. Something's going on and something arises. Whatever it is. And consciousness at that sense door, notices it because all of the three factors are present. Three factors I talked about 10 minutes ago. And then, because we become conscious of it, we've made what's called contact, then Vedana arises. Separate mental formation, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Then, what always happens, here's the next step, depending on the Vedana, we react in one of three habitual patterns. If it's pleasant, then we're grasping at it. We want more. We want to keep it. If it's unpleasant, aversion. Don't want that. Want to push it away. And if it's neutral, then it's like, oh God, boring. Delusion arises, and we go looking for something more interesting that'll catch our attention. What that's the three typical habitual reactive patterns that arise. In all three of those cases, we cling to the object. If it's pleasant, we want to grasp this, we want to cling to it, we want to hold it. So it went from craving or aversion, it now becomes what's called clinging. And this is the thing about clinging is whether it's you want more and you're trying to hold on to it, or you're trying to push it away, you have to cling. You can't push something away if you don't get a really firm grip on it. And that could be physical firm grip, or it could be like a really strong mental grip on that thing. Then you cling to it. Clinging always leads, next step, to identification with the object that's mine. I'm trying to push that thought away, or I'm trying to hold on to this. It's mine. We create a sense of self around the whatever object has arisen. And which, of course, as soon as we start clinging to this object, then because the laws of impermanence are acting, it's going to change. And then we're going to be unhappy. Even though that's just the nature of things. And so clinging always leads to suffering because of the nature of things being impermanent. Clinging leads to suffering. And suffering creates, goes through the cycle again, creating more causes and conditions, and here we go again. So that something else arises. And this continuous cycle is going on all the time. The important thing that the Buddha realized, and the reason he spent so much time talking about Vedana in this teaching, having it as a separate found second whole foundation of mindfulness, is just about Vedana. And in the seven, in the five factors, where he talks about the material world, then there's Vedana, then there's perception, this teaching that he goes, another key teaching. Vedana is there again. It keeps appearing and being singled out. The reason is, if, nope, the big if here, if we can start to tune into Vedana, start to actually note it, ah, that's pleasant, ah, that's unpleasant, ah, that's neutral. It gives us a moment when we can go, oh, I don't have to now crave or be averse. I don't have to have my habitual reactive patterns arising. I can just go, no, I'm going to stop right here. It's a way to, in essence, step out of the cycle. If you can actually see Vedana arising, you step out of the cycle that just is, you know, is always going to lead to craving and aversion and clinging and selfing and more suffering and more causes and conditions. Always is going to happen because it's a process that is just always works the same way. It's a codependent arising. And so if we can start to, in our practice, start to go, oh, that was pleasant. Just stop right there. And not fall into the habitual pattern of, oh, that was pleasant, I want more. That was unpleasant, no, I got to get rid of this, which is where we habitually go. This, if we can start tuning into the Vedana itself, this subtle mental formation that always is there, then we have a way to start slowing down and shifting our habitual patterns so that we don't perpetuate the cycle. And that's why the Buddha puts so much energy and importance on this mental formation. And it's something that he saw. Part of his realization, his enlightenment, was seeing this. Oh, this is... He understood his mind so clearly that he could actually see this and see how powerful it was when he could see it, because it stopped, it slowed down his habitual patterns that always created more suffering. It was a way to short circuit the whole pattern. Okay, so that's the first thing I wanted to say about Vedana. And often when I've talked about Vedana in the past, and some of you have heard me talk about it in the past, this is where I usually stop. But there is this whole other section of this verse that is quite interesting. And it sort of takes this idea to another layer, another level, beyond what I've always talked about. And I'll just read the rest of this verse. When feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly painful feeling. And feeling, and so on. So yes, he goes through all three layers, but now he's dividing them into worldly and unworldly. And believe me, the reason I've avoided this up until now, until I spent some time this week studying, is like, what the heck is going on? It was like, well, worldly and unworldly. What's going on? And so I want to share some stuff that both Analeo and Joseph say about this, because this is sort of like, there's a whole other layer to this teaching that is quite revealing. And so this is from Analeo's book Satipatthana, and it's talking about this division. In the Satipatthana instructions, mindfulness of three feelings is followed by directing awareness to an additional subdivision of feeling into worldly and unworldly. Okay, he's just repeating what I just read essentially. The distinction between worldly and unworldly feelings is concerned with the difference between feelings related to the flesh, in other words, things we experience through the body, and feelings related to renunciation. And I went, I got there and I went, huh? You know, feelings related to renunciation, which is what he's calling unworldly. In other words, they're not arisings from outside stimulation. These are arisings purely from the wholesomeness of our practice. These are these two classifications. Then Enlil goes on. This additional dimension revolves around an evaluation of feeling that is based not on its affective nature, but on the ethical context of its arising. So now he's talking about the virtuous feelings. Vedana can be virtuous. Okay. The basic point introduced here is awareness of whether a particular feeling is related to progress or regress on the path. So regress on the path means, sure enough, there I am falling into my habitual patterns that just create more suffering. As opposed to progress, which means, oh, this is the result of my renunciation. This is a wholesome result. He goes on. Unlike his aesthetic contemporaries, the Buddha did not categorically reject all pleasant feelings, nor did he categorically recommend unpleasant experience for their purifying effect. Instead, he placed emphasis on the mental and ethical consequences of all types of feelings. With the help of the above sixfold classification, this ethical dimension becomes apparent, uncovering in particular the relation of feeling to the activation of latent mental tendencies towards lust, irritation, and ignorance. This habitual patterns I've been talking about. The arising of these underlying tendencies is mainly related to the three worldly types of feelings, whereas unworldly, pleasant, or neutral feelings arise during deep concentration, or unworldly, unpleasant feelings arise only to dissatisfaction with one's own spiritual imperfection, do not stimulate these underlying tendencies. So these unworldly arisings of Vedana don't follow that pattern that I just talked about in the 12 steps of codependent arising. They're separate and they don't have that same effect, which is pretty interesting. I think that this is like that not only could the Buddha see this subtle mental formation, but he could see the differences between these two different forms or different experiences. And then Anileo goes on and he says something else that I think is really interesting. This is in his section on Vedana. He said, his section is called Pleasant Feelings and the Importance of Joy. These unworldly, klutzy word, but you know, these unworldly, wholesome, pleasant, and neutral feelings create joy. This is where the joy in the practice arises, when we're concentrated, and this is when we experience joy. It's the Vedana creating the joy, in a sense. Let me read what he has to say here. The conditioning role of pleasant feelings in leading to likes and eventually to dogmatic attachment has some far-reaching implications, but this does not mean that all pleasant feelings have simply to be avoided. In fact, the realization that pleasant feelings are not simply to be shunned was a direct outcome of the Buddha's own quest for liberation. So this is a direct, he's talking about this direct experience that is a famous story. On the eve of his awakening, so here's the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, he's like being practicing and practicing and practicing. This is what part of what happened. On the eve of his awakening, the Buddha had exhausted the traditional approaches to realization without gaining awakening. While recollecting his past experiences and considering what approach might constitute an alternative, he remembered the time in his early youth when he experienced deep concentration and pleasure, having attained the first absorption, or jhana. This is a layer of deep concentration. Reflecting further on this experience, he came to the conclusion that the type of pleasure experienced was not unwholesome, and therefore not an obstacle to progress. The realization that the pleasure of absorption constitutes a wholesome and advisable type of pleasant feeling marked a decisive turning point in his quest. So absorption arises out of concentration. Concentration, remember, is one of the steps on the Eightfold Path. It's really important because this is the where the importance of concentration becomes so obvious. Based on this crucial understanding, the Buddha was soon able to break through to awakening. To see that it's okay to be happy. To see that it's okay to experience joy in this way. That's what let him break through. Just that. After all his years of practice. This was the deciding factor. The Buddha was soon able to break through to awakening, which earlier, in spite of considerable concentrative attainments and a variety of aesthetic practices, he'd been unable to achieve. After his awakening, the Buddha declared himself to be one who lived in happiness. There's this famous couple of lines in a sutta that comes where the Buddha is describing what happened after his awakening, after he decided to teach, he started to wander to go find these guys he used to hang out with. And as he's walking along, this person was just sort of, you know, a regular person was sort of, you know, cutting grass or something. And the Buddha was walking, and the person looked at him, and he said, "Who are you?" Because it was obvious that this person who was just walking along, there was something really different about him. And the Buddha replied, "I'm the one who no longer suffers," which means he is really happy. No longer suffering. I'm the one who no longer suffers. He was declaring his realization. Because that's, in its essence, is the definition of being awakened. It's the one who no longer suffers. Anyhow. This statement clearly shows that, unlike some of his aesthetic contemporaries, the Buddha was no longer afraid of pleasant feelings. That's an interesting line, right? He's no longer afraid of pleasant feelings. I've known renunciates, people I used to hang out with a long time ago, who were really afraid of pleasant feelings. It was like there was something dangerous about having a good time. You know, they had to sort of be miserable to be pure. As he pointed out, it was precisely the successful eradication of all mental unwholesomeness that caused his happiness and delight. So, because he could be concentrated and because he could accept that this wholesome, joyous feeling he was experiencing was okay, that's what let him go on and practice and teach for another 40 years from this place of being happy. He was He was often actually called the happy one. In certain teachings, you see him called that the happy one. So that's what Anileo has to say. And then I want to share also something from Joseph's book here, where he's talking about the same topic. So, and he's going back to this idea that there are beneficial, wholesome kinds of pleasure and not so wholesome kinds of pleasure. And he's being very precise about this. In the Satipatthana Sutta, it is the instruction on mindfulness of feeling, distinguishing between worldly ones and unworldly ones, that highlights the difference between beneficial and unbeneficial types of pleasure. In the time of the Buddha, there was a wealthy merchant named Visakha living in the ancient city of Rajagaha. Both he and his wife had attained the third stage of enlightenment, called non-returners. In other words, sometime in this life they were going to become enlightened. That's what a non-returner is. Later, his wife was ordained as the nun Dhammadina, and soon finished the spiritual journey, becoming an arhat, became awakened. At one point, Vishaka goes to the nun Dhammadina with a series of questions. So he's now he's going to his wife, who is now not his wife anymore because she's the nun. Right? What habitual tendencies underlie pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings? She responds as might expect. Desire or lust is the conditioned tendency underlying pleasant feeling. Aversion is the underlying condition underneath unpleasant feelings, and delusion is the conditional tendency underlying neutral feelings. And as mentioned previously, without abandoning these underlying tendencies, liberation is not possible. So remember, seeing Vedana gives us a way to start this process of abandoning. But then Visakha goes on to ask a further probing question, one that has great implications for our understanding of the path. Lady Dhammadina, do these habitual tendencies of desire, aversion, and delusion underline all pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings? She replied, these habitual tendencies do not underline all feelings. They do not have to be abandoned in regard to all feelings. She is saying there are some pleasant feelings, secluded from unwholesome states, that lead onward to enlightenment. And there's also some unpleasant feelings that arise from renunciation and do not condition aversion that can also lead to awakening. That's interesting, right? Unpleasant and it leads you to awakening. So, and Joseph goes on. What are these unpleasant feelings not associated with aversion? Because pleasant and neutral is sort of obvious, like the joy, right? How do you get joy out of unpleasant, unworldly feeling tone? Often in practice, we go through stages of meditation that are difficult. There are stages of practice where unpleasant physical sensations predominate, where we might feel fear, misery, or despair about our practice or about the world, and we feel the enlightenment, that enlightenment seems very far away. This is what St. John of the Cross called the dark night of the soul. All of these are unworldly, unpleasant feelings coming out of a deeper place of practice. Likewise, there are neutral feelings that are not associated with delusion or forgetfulness. Worldly neutral feelings are conditioned by the blandness of the objects. Nothing stands out, and so they go unnoticed. Delusion. Unworldly neutral feelings are born of equanimity, and they become very strong in the fourth absorption. This is much deeper concentration. And they become very strong in the fourth absorption and in insight stages called equanimity about formations. At these times, the great refinement of mind, the neutral feelings actually bring more pleasure than pleasant ones. At a certain point, your equanimity, which is the last of the seven factors of awakening, Equanimity is so strong that the calm stillness of equanimity is in and of itself pleasant and brings joy. Dhammadhiti's reply that the habitual tendency to desire, aversion, and delusion do not underline all feelings and so do not have to be abandoned with regard to all feelings points out the different kinds of feelings that arise, both worldly and unworldly. She highlights a different understanding of happiness and the role that this kind of joy plays on the meditative path. The Buddha approved her reply, saying to Vishakha, Dhammadina is wise. If you'd asked me of this, I would have explained it to you in just the same way. So this is like praising his one of his students. And this is like really, I think, this second layer of Vedanta teaching is so critical because it allows us to understand that there's actually a lot of joy that comes out of this practice. That it isn't just grim, serious, that we have to understand that joy in a variety of forms. Gratitude, loving kindness and compassion, equanimity. Those sorts of things are all direct arisings from unworldly Vedana. And they all these wholesome mental formations bring joy. This is where the joy in the practice is, where it really starts to blossom. And it just seems that's important. It's like, and I've certainly, I can speak from personal experience, having, being in some pretty deeply concentrated states at times on long retreats, that it's just like, I mean, I can remember being, I'll tell you one story. This is quite long. It's a six-week retreat. I was actually doing all four Brahma Viharas, 10 days of each. So I'm deep into equanimity practice. There's maybe 3 or 4 days left in the retreat. And it was just one of those really calm, still evenings. And I just finished a long sit. I was sitting long periods. And I was about half an hour before the meal. I said, I think I'll just go for a little walk in the forest because I could walk out of my room and be in the forest. That's what the IMS is like. But I was walking, and I wasn't going for a walk. I wasn't going for exercise. I just walked really, really slowly into the forest. And was this sort of like noticing things, just seeing the green. This is in the fall, so the green that's changing to brown, but there's still green there. And the stones and these old stone walls that run through the grounds there, and the trees. And it was nothing like I hadn't seen it 50 times before, because I've been to this place enough times and walked on that very path many, many times. And I actually got to the point where I started to turn around and just was starting to head back. And the light was sort of shining, because it's getting late in the day. This is October, so it's like before dinner, but it's like the light is already, the angle of the sun is quite, so the light is sort of filtering through the trees and the leaves. And it was like magical. I just stood there. I must have stood there like for 5 minutes and just looked at this, what was there, which is, like I said, I'd seen this stuff many, many times, but somehow or other it just became special and real. And because it was because my mind was so concentrated that I could just take it in, and it was just like one of the most joyful moments I can ever remember. just standing there looking at a bunch of trees, right? I mean, it's nothing like an amazing event. It was just there I was, and the joy was just so intense. It was like, this is what the practice can give you. So it's like, I understand what they're talking about. I've had a few moments like that, like this particular time, other times as well, but this is one in particular that stands out. That's just, it's so clear to me that that's the joy that I was experiencing at that time is so much more than the joy I get from eating a bowl of Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream. Not that I don't still eat Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream, or it's equivalent anyway, the vegan version. That, and that's okay too, but it's like, it's a qualitative and quantitative difference in the joy that arises from these places that just stands out. And it's important that we have these experiences and acknowledge them and say, oh, that's, and remember them, because it's what keeps us practicing. In the long term, I think this is what keeps us practicing, is these moments of pure joy that we experience. We go, oh, yeah. Not that we're trying to create them, that just, and now we just, now we're just grasping things. But knowing that they can occur totally, in this case, I was just like, I was just going for a walk. I wasn't like going out looking for some amazing, joyful experience. I was just going for a walk, walking slowly in the woods. Nothing more than that. Little bit of poetry here to finish. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. Poem called I Am Standing. I'm standing on the dunes in the heat of summer and listening to the mockingbird again, who is tonguing his embellishments. And in the distance, the shy, weed-loving sparrow, who has but one soft song, which he sings again and again. And something somewhere inside my own unmusical self begins humming. Thanks for the beauty of the world. Thanks for my life. That's what those, these moments I'm trying to talk about, that's what's like, it's like you go, oh, thanks for my life. This is a beautiful description of what I'm trying to say.